For the last few weeks, we've been talking here about our Elm City Vineyard mission statement. And I suppose one of the good pieces of news I have for you today is we're done with that. If that's been kind of something that, you know, I don't know. We've been, I won't quiz anybody, but I've heard it said that the Elm City Vineyard exists to call all people to revolutionary lives of action through Spirit-empowered communities that love and obey Jesus Christ. Depends on sometimes where I've seen it written, in all things. So the three things we've been talking about, and we basically said that this is about following Jesus. At the end of the day, that's a fancy sentence to describe what we believe it is to have been called by Jesus, to have Jesus come to us and say, follow me. And this is the best thing we can come up with to describe what it means to do that, to follow Jesus courageously. So we've talked about revolutionary lives of action, we talked about Spirit-empowered communities, we talked about loving and obeying Jesus Christ in all things. And you know, saying that what we're really about is following Jesus is to say we're about two things about our communities. To say that we are Christ-centered and action-oriented, right? Because we're saying that this all basically has to do with Jesus. But it also means, as we talked about, that Jesus must be going somewhere or doing something, and therefore that following him would mean that we are going where he's going and doing the thing that he's doing. And especially that action-oriented part is a quite like felicitous thing for a lot of us here, because we tend to be action-oriented people. So that's a helpful thing. And hopefully, so then over the last few weeks, while we've been talking through each of these things, as we've been talking about our values and who we think God is and who he's called us to be in response, hopefully as we've talked, this has helped make some sense of what it is we do around here, this action-oriented community. So hopefully when we talk about revolutionary lives of action, that's helping make some context for the partners that we work with, that we partner with both financially and also with our time and with our prayer. Many of these organizations, by the way, with whom we partner, represent the 7-day, I know it's supposed to be 5-day, but for most of these people, a 7-day a week kind of walking out of what it means for them to live a life of revolutionary action, a revolutionary life of action in response to who Jesus is and what he's about. And these things are, you know, are doing good work in the city, in our country, and around the world. Yeah, you know, you just heard the plug for your place. Like, you should come get involved in with some of these things. And you have an opportunity to do that, take a first step in that right after church today. But there's more than that, right? Because we don't just have these organizations, but we also have all these people. And we've been wondering, what is it that God's doing by gathering the people that he's gathering here? And one of the things we say, well, we're supposed to be calling one another to revolutionary lives of action. And so we started to wonder about these different kinds of people that God's gathering here, and people are starting to talk. What does it mean that we have all these scientists here? I did a Google search for Beaker, and that's what came up. So, you know, what does it mean? Scientists, seriously, what does it mean that we have so many scientists here trying to follow God? What does it mean to live a revolutionary life of action as a scientist? What does it mean that God has put so many people here with such deep passion for global development and mission, especially in the Middle East and in the Muslim world? What is that all about? What's going on there? What does it mean that we have all these parents here? What does it mean to parent a child into a revolutionary life of action? What does that look like? People are starting to talk about that, starting to talk together. Asha Evans may have something to say at that point. If I mention it from up here, I'm hoping that might pressure her into making that a reality, except that she's downstairs at the moment. Such is life. She'll listen on the website. But then we have these other kinds of crazy scholars, the ones that do more humanities kinds of stuff, people who study religion, people who study culture, people who study history. What is it about that God has gathered all of these people here? And so, I don't think that's, see, there you go, that's how this could work. Beautiful. So what's that all about, right? We want to see what God is doing in calling these people together and what God is doing here and what that's all about. And so hopefully when we talk about revolutionary lives of action, we've explained what that's all about. Hopefully this starts to make sense of some of these things that we do. When we talk about spirit-empowered communities, yeah, we do tend to think primarily of our home groups. If you haven't been to a home group, I was about to say shame on you. No, if you haven't been to a home group, like, come check one out. This is the thing we believe, that God has called us to live life together in the presence of the Spirit and in the presence of one another. But it's not even just about home groups, right? Because I think that when we talk about spirit-empowered communities, we also are thinking about the kinds of conversations that happen every day around the kitchen table. Probably the most sacred place in the world, if you think about the place that's actually going to change your life and your habits and your activities. Those conversations that happen in real fellowship with real friendships that are developed around here. So All of these things hopefully start to make sense of some of the stuff we do. But what about Sundays? Well, I mean, presumably, as we've seen for the last few weeks, Sundays is a great place that we can, like, give talks and talk about what it is that we're supposed to be about the rest of the week. And that's not a trivial thing. That's an important thing. And we find that on Sundays, we have time to pray for one another. We have time to kind of, as an amalgamation of many spirit-empowered communities, to be, it's like Voltron or something, like one big spirit-empowered community, and we can pray for one another and hope to see God come and meet us in that. But there's this one goofy thing that we do that doesn't necessarily fit into this, especially if we think about ourselves as an action-oriented community. We waste our time getting together and singing, right? In an action-oriented community, this can seem like such like a waste of time. After all, we know that like kingdom business is about life out there. It's about doing things. There's justice, things to pursue. There's the kingdom of God breaking into the world, and here we are in here singing a bunch of songs. So I think that, and certainly there are things that happen in worship that are tied into our mission statement. We do believe that we encounter the Spirit there. Probably loving Jesus has a lot to do with worship. But I think in general, worship is one of the least described things that we do around here. So for the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about what is worship? What is this all about? Why do we worship? And I think it's an appropriate time of the year to do it because in the Christmas story at Advent, we find people worshiping all over the place. Mary, Joseph, the shepherds, the Magi, Zechariah, Elizabeth, Simeon, and Anna. If you don't know who some of those people are, you'll find out. You probably know who Mary and Joseph are. If not, you can come to the Christmas pageant and ask for a costume. But the Christmas story is full of images of people worshiping. And so we want to take a moment to take a look at worship. And the question we want to ask is, what is the purpose for today? What is the purpose of worship for a Christ-centered, action-oriented community following Jesus? And I want to take a look. I mean, worship is one of these words that we use a lot in churches that you probably don't use too much else. I guess maybe otherwise you talk about celebrities, right? People maybe like worship a celebrity. But outside the church, we don't really use this word worship. And certainly within the church, we use the word worship in ways that if you have not a whole lot of experience with the church would be completely mystifying to you. Maybe it is. Where in churches, I heard a couple weeks ago, a pastor used the word worship as a synonym for music. Now, if you've been in a church long enough, you can roll with that. He was talking about the style of our worship being one from a list of musical genres. So there's this larger concept though in worship. In the church, we say that we can talk about worship as a lifestyle of obedience, and it's especially become common and important over the last few years as kind of the worship industry has taken off and Time Life Books is like selling collections of worship songs and stuff. The church has like in response to that said like, hold on, there's much more to worship than just music, which is absolutely true. In fact, the whole life of following Jesus can be described as a life of worship. Documents as old at least as like the Westminster Catechism seem to say almost exactly that, our purpose being to glorify God. But today I want to talk about, in the more limited sense, I do want to talk about worship as like this thing that we do on Sundays or this thing that we do in home groups. And the reason I want to focus on that for today is because I want to talk about precisely this feeling that we might have as an action-oriented community that worship seems to be unrelated to this. And if we just decided that like worship is a word that we can use to describe all of these things we want to run out and go do, then we'd kind of miss the point. So for today, we're going to be thinking about worship as this thing that we do on Sundays and in home groups when we say, all right, one, two, three, now we will worship. So I want to talk about what is the nature of worship. There's something true in this thing. Like worship's not just music. So, but what is worship really about? And unfortunately, I think this is one of these things that the Bible is not that clear about. If you looked at the majority, certainly, of Old Testament texts and you wanted to find out about the nature of worship, you would find a text that looks something like this. All right, this is from the beginning of Leviticus. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you shall offer a male without blemish. You shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting for acceptance in your behalf before the Lord. You shall lay your hand upon the head of the burnt offering. It shall be accepted, etc., etc. This is where you cut it. This is what you do with inside of it, and you put it on the altar, and this is how it goes. This is explanation of what worship is. And that doesn't seem to be all that helpful. And we really don't have too much that talks about in the Old Testament about the heart of worship. Maybe some psalms start to get at it. But I think the reason that the Bible's not too concerned to talk about kind of the essence of worship is because it was so obvious to the first people who were encountering it. There are many words in Hebrew for worship, but perhaps the most common one, the most central one, is this word chava. For the Hebrew scholars among us, you will never see this word like this in the wild. It's only used in the Hishtafel or something. So that is a little shout out there. So you might think of this as like Yishchat. I looked this up under the wrong thing because I'd always seen it that way. Anyway, but this word simply means bow down. And the use of this in a liturgical context, the use of this word in the context of our interaction with God, is actually on analogy to the primary meaning that anybody would have known when they talked about worship, which is you come before a king and you bow down. Quite simple. And then on analogy, we might describe various things that we do as religious people as being kind of like that in our relationship with God. So when you said worship in ancient Israel, it was clear enough what you meant. You meant coming to God and bowing down. And when you come and you bow down before someone, right? And this is not just like bowing, like if you have this idea, you know, of like, you know, bow or something. No, have you ever heard of the phrase prostrate oneself in worship? In Hebrew, that would be a redundant concept, right? You prostrate yourself, and that is what worship is. So in prostrating yourself, I'm sorry for you in the back. It's something, you know, you're not just like going down on your knees, you're not just bending over, but you've got your face planted on the ground, okay? And that is the idea of worship. So when you talk about worship, there's something about being in that position that communicates something really, really strong and really, really visceral. When you are on your face flat in front of someone, you're not entering into a conversation with them as equals. You're not coming before this king and saying, hey, king, let's chat about the options here. Hey, king, I wanted to have a conversation with you about the right strategy in this particular campaign that we're dealing with. No, when you come and you bow down and your face is flat on the ground, you're saying, I'm vulnerable, I'm exposed, what you say will go. And so I think this is the core of what it means to worship. To worship, then, is to assume a posture of submission before a king. To worship God is to assume a posture of submission before God, the King of heaven. Worship is submission. Worship means lying prostrate before God without self-consciousness and without pretense. Worship means the end of my agenda and the beginning of God's agenda, the end of my desires, of my program, and the beginning of God's desires and God's program and plan for my life. It's why it's so important to say that worship is so much more than song. Worship is about assuming a posture before God that yields everything to Him. And if we want to use music to do that, we have tons of historical precedent on our side. But if you found that you instead wanted to write a poem, or you wanted to dance, or you wanted to paint, or whatever else you wanted to do, you're still on target so long as you're doing something that expresses submission before God. And so in this image, at least as I imagine it, you'd bow down before a king. You bow, and then the king lifts your head, and two things happen. The king tells you something about who you are. Perhaps you get a new name. Perhaps you get a new title. And then the king says what you are to do. And I think in worship, these are the things that can happen. As we come and we submit our hearts before God, God says, all right, this is who you are. This is what I have for you to do. This is, and the key for us in worship is that though the king has invited us into his presence and he has initiated with us, we come and our stance in worship is a stance of submission before we know precisely what's on the table. We just come and bow down, and we make ourselves vulnerable before God. The key part of worship is the way that it describes a relationship, the way that it defines a relationship. Worship is the DTR of our relationship with God, a DTR being a define the relationship talk. If you have an ambiguous relationship of a romantic variety, you sit down and you have a DTR, which is not a date, right? It's like somehow stands outside the list. Hannah and I, we had this... I wanted to ask Hannah out for a long time before I did. The story of Hannah and my DTR was somewhat comical. We had been spending a lot of time together ever since the beginning of our freshman year, but about somewhere in the middle of my sophomore year, a year during which I had committed not to date anyone, it became clear that I was only making good on that promise, like in name, in as much as I was spending all this time with Hannah, and we were not dating. But I wanted to talk to her about this thing, and so I kept looking for a good opportunity, and literally, I mean, it was a comedy of errors. Kept trying to find a time, and she couldn't make this, or she couldn't do that, or someone was always there. The time when I remember being most frustrated, it was right before spring break, and Hannah and a bunch of folks were coming to my parents' house. And I thought, if I go to my parents' house, if I go and bring this woman into my mother's house, and it's not on the table that, like, we're together and I'm very interested in her, like, this will never work. My mother is going to, like just be too amused by this. This is not going to work. This needs to get out on the table. And so it's coming down to the last day before spring break, or the last day before we were going to go out to Chicago. We were watching the NCAA basketball finals or semifinals or something over at Hannah's house, or Hannah's dorm room. And there were four of us or five of us there, maybe more than that. And we were watching, and then the game ended, and a few people took off right after the game ended. And then a couple more people straggled out after a while. It was late, you know, it was like midnight, and then it was 1 o'clock. And pretty soon it was just Hannah, her friend Joy, and me. And so I just thought, you know what, spring break starts tomorrow. Like, this is simple. I do not leave until Joy leaves. Like, I'm just staying here. And it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. It's getting towards like 2:15. And Hannah's told me later, she was kind of wondering, like, why I just wouldn't go anywhere. And so I'm just hanging around until finally at like 2:45, Joy turns to Hannah and says, oh my goodness, it's 2:45. Do you mind if I just spend the night here? And I was like, no! Which all ended up with Hannah indeed coming to Chicago, my mom being entirely too amused by this whole process. But it was actually kind of a good thing, because then Hannah got a chance to meet my family without... she was kind of undercover. My parents knew everything, because I just thought at that point I'd just have to tell my mom, all right, this girl coming, she's kind of special. You're going to make fun of me anyway, so there it is. So Hannah didn't know that she was meeting, like, my parents for the first time, but she was meeting my parents for the first time, and it worked out. We had the DTR later over at Yorkside or something. Most of the significant moments in my life have happened at Yorkside. But worship is the DTR of our relationship with God. And maybe you've kind of had that like defining moment in your relationship with God, that kind of one defining moment. But worship is this opportunity for us to enter in to kind of reestablishing the nature of this relationship that we have with God over and over, where we say, primarily, the content is quite simple. God, you are God, and I am not. This is the simple establishment of a relationship that happens in worship, in which we come and submit ourselves to God. And so then, like that king who then lifts up your head and says who you are and then tells you to go do something, worship then isn't unrelated to this life of obedience. It's not unrelated to this life of following Jesus. There's actually quite a tight relationship. Authentic worship yields fruit of obedience. If you bow down before a king, then he stands you up and says, Todd, I have a thing for you to do. And you say, no thank you. You have missed the point of the bowing down. All right? Authentic worship yields fruit of obedience, right? When we come and we say, God, this is who I am, this is who you are, this is the kind of life I want to lead, now I'm going to screw it up, fair enough. But the fruit of authentic worship, if you want to know whether your worship is authentic, you need to wait a little while. See, how are things going? A couple weeks ago, I was at a vineyard area meeting, and I was leading a lunchtime discussion for worship leaders. And there are a few worship leaders sitting around, and we were talking about what's the nature of worship. But one of the things that often comes up when you talk with folks who are involved in leading worship is, how do we know, like, this is going well, right? As a worship leader, you'll have people come up to you after gatherings and stuff and say things like, great worship today. And you're like, I hope God thought so too. Or like, thank you. I mean, you know, like, you have no idea. Like, what does it mean for worship to be great? And so we're talking about how do we know if this is working? How do we know if this is any good? And I suggested to them that the best way for us to judge the effectiveness of worship is in the obedience of the lives of our community. So how do you know if worship is working? The people in your community start to look more and more like Jesus. I mean, not looking. The lives of the people in your community start to look more and more like Jesus. Authentic worship yields fruit of obedience. And you know, I mentioned a few weeks ago, Caleb and my now storied essay that has not been written, In Praise of Hypocrisy. This kind of problem that we can have, authenticity is a concern that we have, but there are two ways, right, to make sure that your worship is authentic, right? You may have figured out the other way. I just talked about one. But there's that actually much easier way, right, to make your worship authentic. Change the words of your worship songs to match the life that you're going to live anyway, right? So you might end up singing songs, you know, like this one. Oh God, you are okay. I think you have some really good ideas. When I can, I will do my best to implement them when it doesn't cost too much. I can see that you want more, but my life simply as it is, I could make promises, but I'm unlikely to do anything about them. We could put up this song and we could sing like the most authentic worship if we just wanted the one-to-one matching, right, of words with like lives that follow. But obviously, like, this is the cheap way out. Instead, if you're worried about the authenticity of your worship, then we need to make it good with lives that are lived in submission to God. The lives that look like the lives that we sing about and the lives that we talk about and the lives that we so desperately want to live when we have these moments of encounter with God. When worship is real, when worship is authentic, a life like Jesus's comes about. A life of submission, of obedience to God comes about. When worship is happening, things like what comes off of Mary's lips in the Christmas story suddenly start to come out of your mouth. Then Mary said, "Here I am, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." Mary, right, this young adult, probably younger than most people in this room, been told what God's plans are going to mean for her life, what it's going to cost her in terms of social status, everything she has that's going to cost her. And her response is, I know who I am. I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be unto me as you have said. And we know that Mary had an intense, profound worshiping life. Right after this in the story, she sings a spontaneous song of praise that is known to the church as the Magnificat, and is perhaps one of the most astonishing songs of worship the church has ever had. That kind of life of worship, that kind of discipline of worship, gives a life of obedience and a life of submission that we could do well to imitate. So ultimately, that's the deal. Our worship is absolutely related to what God is calling us to be, who God's calling us to be, and what God's calling us to do. Worship is a waste, people have said. It's a wonderful waste. when we sing songs, we are just as far from accomplishing God's purposes in the world as someone who bows down before a king is in accomplishing what that king would have them do. Bowing down accomplishes in itself nothing, but it establishes a relationship that can be powerful as it's lived over a lifetime. Same thing in worship, we discipline our hearts, we practice a posture in our hearts that we hope to walk out, the other things of life. So as we worship today, I would encourage you to bring into our time of worship areas where you don't know maybe where God is calling you. Maybe you're not even exactly sure who he's called you to be. There are fundamental questions that you have and you're unsure. I would encourage you to bring those into our time of worship. Bring those in. As you can say, you know what, God, I don't get this right now. I don't see where you're going. I don't see what this is all about. But before I get a clear picture on that, I just ask for what you have. This is going to be our relationship. You're going to say, go, and I'm going to say, yes. You're going to say, be this, and I'm going to say, yes, Lord. And maybe even more importantly would be if there are areas of your life where you sense that God might be leading you somewhere, but you're hesitant to follow God's leading. Maybe through the various ways that we believe we hear from God, through reading scripture, through praying and listening, through wise people who you've talked to who also follow God, you're starting to get a picture of something that God might be asking you to do or something God might be calling you to change in your life, and you're just not sure you like God's plan. Man, bring that in at our time of worship. And as we worship, let's bow down. Say, God, this is not a dialogue. This is not a conversation of equals. Help me even, right? My favorite prayer in all of Scripture. I believe. Help my unbelief. I want to submit my heart to you. Would you even help me submit my heart more and more to you? So we can think about that as we worship today. One last thing. This whole bowing down before a king thing is quite a bit foreign to us. Maybe some of you are even feeling like it feels a little bit backwards or a little like medieval, maybe literally. But it is not the way we normally like to think about God. And we talked about this a little while back when I was talking about obedience. I feel like we have a good opportunity, especially in Advent, to remind ourselves of who this king is to whom we bow down. That in the Christmas story, we actually find the image of worship transformed as kings come and bow down before a child, before a baby. And that so that when we come in worship, especially in this season of Advent, and as we're thinking about God's coming into the world as the baby Jesus in some random corner in the middle of nowhere, as a child, that this is who God is for us. Long before we did anything, God has invited us in. Before even there was an us to invite in, God said, you know what, I'm going to be for you. We don't have some disinterested king just kind of like high on power to whom we are bowing down in worship, but we have a loving God who has shown, demonstrated his being for us in coming and becoming one of us and walking with us and walking in the obscure places of our world and experiencing the things that we experience. This is the mystery of the incarnation, something that people have puzzled over in the church for centuries and will continue to do for centuries to come, that God would come and become one of us, this God who still is worthy of our worship, as the shepherds and the magi and everybody else shows, still a child. Still worthy of our worship, worthy of our praise, maybe even more so, because he's shown who he is for us and who he's willing to be, what he's willing to do for us. We serve and we bow down before a humble king, for a humble God, a God who's walked where we've walked, who knows our pain, who loves us enough to come and to humble himself. St. Augustine said, "A proud humanity is a great misfortune, but an even greater mercy is a humble God." And this is the God whom we worship. This is the God whom we encounter as we worship, as we come before him and submit our hearts and say, "Not my will, but yours, Lord. Lead me, teach me." So I'm going to invite up the band, the worship team.